All right, so I think we should get started. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. My name is Paul Andrew, and I'm a technical product manager on the Office 365 team in Redmond. And I cover identity management for Office 365 and also networking and data centers and performance with Office 365. So some interesting topics there. They're mostly back-end. I don't work on the UX for Office 365. Sometimes I don't know my way around the UX as much as my way around the data centers or the networks. So this morning we're going to talk about internet connection planning and troubleshooting. So there's three parts to this talk. First, I'll talk a little bit about the infrastructure that Microsoft has, the infrastructure in our data centers, the infrastructure around our network. And then I'll talk a bit about capacity planning, which is about planning for your internet connectivity for your users to connect to Office 365, which is, of course, done over the internet. So we're talking about internet connectivity and bandwidth capacity planning that you'll need. And then the third part of the talk, we'll talk about troubleshooting. If you have users that are having performance issues of whatever kind, what are some of the steps that you can take to look at those performance issues that they're having and troubleshoot your way through those? Does this sound good? All right. Can everyone hear me at the back? We're good to go. And my screen my picture fills the whole screen, so it's beautiful. I brought the wrong cable. I've got my micro HDMI to VGA, and I was supposed to bring micro HDMI to HDMI, and I brought the wrong one. So we had a bit of fun before the talk there. All right, see if we can... Yep, okay. So first, let's talk a little bit about Microsoft data centers. Microsoft has been in the data center business for a long time. I've got a little timeline here showing some of the data center work that we've done as a company. And over time, we've learned a lot of things about building data centers, so much that we have a dedicated organization called Global Foundation Services that manage, own, and maintain Microsoft's data centers. So when you're using Office 365, you're using software that's developed by the Office team, and we build that on top of VMs and servers and infrastructure that's built by this team, Global Foundation Services. They bring our new data centers online, they put the networking in, they get the power set up, and all of that kind of hard stuff, and then they give us access to those data centers to put our services in. So that's the GFS team. They started in the mid-2000s. Another important group, the Trustworthy Computing Initiative, which is generally owned by the Microsoft Security Response Center. The MSRC is a team at Microsoft that if there's any kind of security breaches or concerns that people have about security, they are on point to pick those up and lead resolution of those kind of problems. So they're a very important part of Microsoft's data center as well. So lots of great experiences there. Something which is hard to replicate if you're looking at building out your own set of data centers. Microsoft has invested over $15 billion in this infrastructure, and we have over 100 data centers in a lot of different locations. We actually have a private network that connects all of those data centers. It's not so much private as it's actually a public network that connects those data centers, which we make available for Microsoft customers to connect to the data centers as well as communications between our data centers. It's actually a very large network. It's one of the largest three networks in the world, larger than all of the telcos. Because it's worldwide and not just focused on a single country. We have endpoints for that network in 23 different countries, including where we have data centers and other places that we just have internet connectivity presences. We are connected with a large number of ISPs. You can see 1,500 ISPs listed there through 50 interconnection points in those 23 countries. So one network, 23 countries, 50 interconnection points, and 1,500 ISPs. That still leaves some ISPs that we don't have contracts with, so that's not all of the ISPs in the world, but it is a pretty large number. In those 50 locations in 23 countries, each of those locations is going to be a router where we have a fiber connection into, and then ISPs and network operators also have fiber connections into that. So our network connects worldwide, and then other ISPs will connect into that. And this is generally what makes up the internet, is a lot of different network operators connecting into these fiber switches and routing traffic between them. All right. So I have a map here just showing where some of this is located. And you can see the rectangles in green are locations where Microsoft has data centers that host Office 365 services. And these are the ones which we have disclosed. There are some data center locations which are not disclosed. They're not listed on the map. We have also announced that we are going to have a data center in India for Office 365. It's not operational yet. It's not shown on the map there. And there's a few other data centers where we don't have Office 365 services today, notably Japan, Australia, and Chien. I think that's in Wyoming. Cheyenne? All right. We don't have Office 365 there, so I don't know very much about it. We have actually announced that we're going to bring Office 365 to Japan, so we're going to run services out of the Microsoft data centers that we have there. Recently, we announced Azure services out of Australia, so we're going to host those there as well. If you look at this map, it's interesting to note that the Office 365 services that Microsoft has are grouped into different regions. So if you look at in the US, we have five data centers that are identified there, and that's considered one region of North America. And so we host customers out of North America out of those five data centers. And the way that we do that is when you put in your billing address and you sign up for service, we look at the country, and we have a mapping of country to data center regions. Question?
Quickly, I'm a global company.
Yep.
And we have, I hear that part. I suppose I've got somebody in Shanghai, Singapore, Amsterdam, and the U.S., and that's my global footprint. Do they all log into the U.S. if I'm a U.S. company?
So the question is, if I'm a global company and I have customers all over the world, can they still log into my portal, even though my tenant is located out of data centers in the US? And the answer is, of course, yes. Microsoft has a worldwide network connecting all of these data centers, and it has a lot of excess capacity. We call it headroom, which is available for customers using our data centers. And the way that works is if you have a user, and maybe that user is in Amsterdam. We've got obviously data centers in Amsterdam, but their mailbox is in the US data centers. So what's going to happen is wherever the internet service provider that you're using, it has routes to Microsoft data centers, and those routes are going to tell it to connect to the Microsoft network, probably in Amsterdam, and then that traffic will be routed over Microsoft's network across to the US, across the Atlantic. So you get to take advantage of the headroom that Microsoft has and the bandwidth that we have available, rather than just connecting over the internet, because you're routing to a Microsoft data center. And traffic going back the other way will route the same way. Whereas if you were just connecting to a web server that was not related to Microsoft in the US and you were in Amsterdam, then you'd connect over the public internet and you'd be competing with other people using the public internet there. So we do offer that bandwidth dedicated for Microsoft customers. This network is also used by our Bing search service. It's also used by the Microsoft download servers. All of the other Microsoft services that we provide use this worldwide network. If your billing address was out of a location in Europe, or in fact in the Middle East or Africa, then you'd be located out of these Dublin and Amsterdam data centers. And if you're if you set up if your billing address is out of APAC, then you'd be located in our Singapore and Hong Kong data centers. We actually offer a separate service for customers in China. So if you connect to our service, which is out of China, it's operated by a partner called 21 ViaNet, then you can use our Shanghai and other data centers in China. And customers in Brazil, if you put in your address, country as Brazil, then we host that out of data centers in Brazil and actually San Antonio. So those are our different regions where we host customers. But wherever the users are around the world, they'll be using the Microsoft network to connect to those data centers. Another question here?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Another thing that I already know is an issue for us, for China users and the China wall, what do you do to get around the China wall? Not really get around it, but at least manage that to where your speed is brought to the standard.
So questions about users in China. And in fact, internet connectivity in China is challenging. And there's a few different reasons because of that. One you brought up is the Chinese government have a firewall that they put on the perimeter of the country. Internet service providers in China can also be very challenging to work with and get good bandwidth out of. Actually, more often than not, the internet service providers are more of a challenge than the Great Firewall. But you really have to do a lot of work in troubleshooting and making sure that you have good internet connectivity in China, connecting out of China. One common way that people do that is to lease their own network connectivity, both within China and from China to outside of China. That certainly avoids the issues with the network providers in China. However, if you are reliant on those network providers, then you've got some work to do to work with those. If you have a lot of different locations in China, it can be very expensive to run your lease your own networking and do that kind of thing. So certainly a difficult problem. Another question? For large deployments, the option that you have is the billing address for your country, and we will locate the tenant based on that, largely in these three different regions of the Americas, Europe, and APAC. Oh, I see. So we actually replicate the data across all of the data centers used by the particular service. And so if you're out of North America, those five data centers are what we've disclosed for all of Office 365. We use different data centers for different services. But certainly we will replicate mailboxes across four or more data centers which are across those five locations. Yep. Yep. So the question is, for the networking, Microsoft has a global network, I think if I follow the question, you're saying, is Microsoft's network in Shanghai? And it is. Yep.
All the green points on that map, I'm assuming, are points where you can enter that network, and but there are more. Is Shanghai one of them or not?
So, unfortunately, it's a much more difficult question to answer. The question is Shanghai a node on Microsoft's network? And there are, for a variety of reasons, it's difficult to answer. We do have networking into China, but you may or may not be able to take advantage of that if you have users there. Unfortunately, it's a much longer conversation than we can break this session to get into, but it does relate to the types of agreements that we establish with different ISPs, where those ISPs choose to get their routing information from, how they provide that to you as a user, and that's dependent on where you are connecting from. So depending on where you are connecting from, what those routing agreements are, the internet uses BGP routing, which is fairly straightforward, but has to be there and has to be set up appropriately to make use of those networks. So yes, maybe, maybe not, no. One of those answers is correct, depending on where you are. Microsoft does have that network connectivity across all of these data centers, though. We'll actually spend a little bit more time on this a little bit later on. I'll show you a couple of techniques that you can use to help with troubleshooting this as we go a little bit further on. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about another technology that Microsoft has, and this is called the Microsoft Edge. And this is a service that we use primarily for Microsoft download services, where we have these Edge nodes in a large number of different locations. Actually, we have these Edge nodes for Microsoft download services in many more locations than this. But what we're doing is we're starting to use these same Edge nodes for Office 365. And this is a project that we've started. It's a work in progress that we'll keep going on. But with the Microsoft download server, Windows Update is a very, very big user of that download service. And so we've deployed these edge nodes, which are essentially caches for files to be downloaded from Windows Update, patches to Windows operating system and such. So we've deployed these all over the world. And what we're doing now with Office 365 is we're looking at each of these edge nodes and trying to figure out, well, are they compliant with the security requirements we have for transiting Office 365 data across the network and through those nodes. And so far we have 22 of those nodes which we've been able to classify in that way. And that relates to the security of the site, whether it's got cameras, whether it's got full-time staff at the site. Many of these sites are literally hosting providers where Microsoft has contracted with them to host these download caches. And for if you're just hosting some basically free public Windows Update services, then we don't have the same security requirements we have if we're transiting customer data for Office 365 through those nodes. So we're working through that. We currently have 22 of these live, and they are hosting the Office 365 portal right now. Obviously, there's a lot more services in Office 365 than just the portal, and there's a lot more nodes that we have. So this is a project that's underway, but it's another great way that we can make use of that existing network and bring performance improvements to customers using Office 365. All right, I want to tell you a little bit about why this Edge project is so important. And this comes down to how far away a user is from the server that is terminating their network connection. Now, terminating the network connection is part of the low level of your network connectivity. And the TCP protocol sets up with a SYN ACK, and then an ACK packet. So there's a little bit of a handshake going on there before you can send any data. And because we use SSL for all our connectivity, there's more handshake again to set up the SSL connection. So you can see some of this, the back and forth that goes on. And if that back and forth is happening from the user to a node, which is a long way away, say maybe across the other side of the world, then there's quite a bit of setup time that we want to reduce and get out of that. There's also other things that happen because of a longer round trip time that you would have if you're client is connecting to a server that's a long way away. And so we can remove all of this delay by using these edge nodes, even if the edge nodes are only acting as a network endpoint for that traffic. And so we've seen pretty significant improvements in test, and this is why we're rolling this out. I've got an example there of a customer down in South America connecting to an edge node, and so they can connect to this edge node which can have essentially hot TCP connections or open SSL connections into our data center that it can use instead of connecting all the way up to the data center. So we're looking at making use of this for other parts of Office 365 services as well. All right, so we started talking a little bit about Microsoft's network, and we had a few good questions there. We actually share all of where our network peering is at this site called PeeringDB. PeeringDB is just an international public site where people share information about their global networks, and Microsoft has the network ASN number 8075, so you can actually go and look this up on that site. Maybe not right now, depending on the internet connectivity that you have in the room, but you can actually go and take a look at this and... If you are working with an ISP or a network operator and you don't find them connected to Microsoft, you can actually invite them to go and establish peering agreement with Microsoft at microsoft.com/peering. And these peering agreements are largely described on this site. There's two types of peering agreements that happen. One is a peering agreement about routing information, and the other is a peering agreement about a physical interconnection. And the physical interconnection is literally when you have a piece of fiber optic cable that's part of the Microsoft network connected into a fiber switch that the network operator also has a connection into. And sometimes these are called fiber switch hotels. They're typically in network operator premises where they have a large number of these switches and there's a lot of cables that are connected into those buildings. The other option is if we just have a routing agreement. So a routing agreement is, of course, much easier to set up, but there's still an agreement which we would have with a network operator to share routing information. And then, of course, it's up to them to make use of that routing information and populate that throughout their network. And that routing information enables users on that network to be able to route into the Microsoft network, into our physical network as quickly as possible so that you can connect to Microsoft Data Center. But anyway, this site's a great resource. As an exercise, I actually went up to the site. It's a public site. And took a look at all the locations where the Microsoft 8075 network is situated. And you can see all the cities that came up. Now, there's one piece of advice I want to give you if you're looking at this site and you're looking at where your users are connecting from, is that you have to look at this data with a grain of salt. It's much more important to actually be in that city, talking to that network operator and seeing how their routes are set up, than to just look up this database. Sometimes the peering locations may be what's called off-net. Off-net means there is no fiber connection. It's just an agreement to do routing. Sometimes there may be multiple connection points in a particular city, so you aren't always able to see that in the peering DB. Not everything that you see in that database is 100% guaranteed to be up to the minute, up to date. And of course, I did this in July earlier this year, so it may be out of date as well. These things change very frequently. They change with network expansion. They change with network outages. It is really surprising how much change goes on in this space. All right, so the last thing that I want to talk about here in terms of things that Microsoft has made available to make sure performance for end users is really good is offline caching and syncing of data. So we have clients, not only our rich clients such as Outlook and the OneDrive for Business Sync tool, but also Outlook Web Access is actually able to cache your data offline. If you set that into offline mode, you can actually use OWA in offline, and that's actually the mode that the mobile Outlook Web Access uses, which is what people commonly use on iPads and iPhones and Android devices. So that offline sync means you're syncing in the background and your users aren't going to notice as much if there are network performance issues that are going on. All right, so talking through all of this, what I want to get through to you is it's not just a case of there's a user and there's the internet, the cloud, and then there's the Microsoft data centers. There's a lot of things in between the users and the servers that are in the data centers. And it's worthwhile thinking about what these are. And if you're looking at what you have to provision for end users and how they connect into the internet and how they connect to Office 365, there's a few more things to look at. We talked about the Microsoft public network, and we talked about these edge nodes, and we talked a little bit about peering and routing already. Microsoft also uses content delivery networks, where static public files don't have to be loaded out of a Microsoft data center. They don't have to be loaded out of that SharePoint Online server. They can be hosted in a CDN network. Microsoft has CDN networks based out of Azure, and we also use third-party CDN networks both for SharePoint Online and Exchange Online to host static files. And CDN networks essentially are in every city in the world. So if you're loading those files, those can be excluded from what you have to be concerned about coming back from the data center. And the last thing to look at is the internet connection that you have in each of the locations where you have users. And oftentimes there's a lot that can be done to look at those internet connections and optimize them for SaaS applications, optimize them for Office 365, as opposed to just users connecting from their PCs to do web browsing. So we're going to take a look at that in the next part, take a look at how users and PCs, and you can plan that internet connection. Did I go too fast? Okay. So as we're thinking about planning the internet connection that you have, we want to look at, essentially, you're thinking about if one user uses X bandwidth to connect to the Office 365 services that they need, then 10 users are going to use 10X bandwidth, and 1,000 users are going to use 1,000X bandwidth. So we want to figure out that we've got the right amount of bandwidth and we've configured our perimeter network appropriately for connecting to Office 365. And so we recommend this process that's sometimes called baselining, to figure the network connection bandwidth that you need. And there's a couple of aspects to this. First, you probably already have internet connections at all of the locations where your users are connecting from. Everybody does, right? So you want to figure out how much of that internet connection is already being used and how much headroom is available at each location. And then once you've figured that out, then you want to understand, well, how much more connectivity, how much more bandwidth is going to be used because I'm suddenly moving all of my document storage and all of my mail up into the cloud. And I've got Outlook users connecting up to the cloud in order to get their mail and look at their mail. And I've got people synchronizing their data from their local PCs up into OneDrive for Business and that sort of thing. So essentially, you want to figure out, well, how much more do I need to do? And how we think about that is, well, how much bandwidth do users use now when they're using those same services? How much bandwidth do they require connecting from Outlook to wherever their Exchange server is before you move to Office 365? And how much bandwidth do they use connecting from their PCs to SharePoint, wherever that is hosted right now? So we can use tools like Netmon. Netmon is a packet capture tool which you can run on a PC and it will capture all of the network traffic that goes in and out of that PC, and you can identify the amount of bandwidth going to those services by doing that. Perfmon, running on the Exchange servers, can help you to understand how much data is going from those Exchange servers to the Outlook users. And sometimes you can get better data by actually going to the internet firewalls and internet routers and looking at the traffic that's actually going through them and figuring out where that is coming to and from. What you're essentially trying to do is saying, okay, if my users are using this much bandwidth now for their mail and file use, what's going to happen when I move all of that to the internet, and how's that going to change? There's a question at the back here.
Yeah, the environments like Fast Track and the trial, the public trials, those are actually sitting in the production data centers, right? So that bandwidth you're talking about would be an accurate representation.
Correct, yeah. So the question is Fast Track and proof of concepts, any trials that you create on Office 365, we put all of those in the production data centers. And so when you switch those from Fast Track or trial to purchase, they're in the same location. So yeah, a great example of doing a great test for your users' bandwidth is if you have 100 users and you're running on Fast Track and you actually have 100,000 users, start with those 100 users. Make sure that they're actually using the service, because it doesn't do you no good having a proof of concept where the users haven't switched on. This happens very often. So you've got to look at how many of my users are actively using the service and have really migrated. Then if you can go and measure the amount of bandwidth that those users are using and where they're connecting to, you can multiply that out by the number of users you have to extrapolate to figure how much network capacity you're actually going to require. All right. So we actually run, I know our consulting services guys run these bandwidth capacity planning exercises as part of setting up new customers with Office 365. You can actually go and do this yourself. Some things that you want to take a look at is the different workloads and how they use bandwidth. Exchange Online is very similar to on-premises. And your users connecting from Outlook, connecting to Exchange Online, are going to be similar to those users connecting to Exchange on-premises. Some differences you're going to see is that, well, hopefully you already have the latest version of Outlook, because the latest version of Outlook can reduce the amount of traffic that you use, but that's going to be similar whether you're connecting to Exchange on-premises or Exchange Online. It will use those new protocols. We have, with Outlook 2013 SP1, we have MAPI over HTTP, avoiding the RPC protocol, which adds some amount of bandwidth, and removing that can improve the reliability that we have with that. Question?
Yeah, just regarding, what about firewall connections? Because we have several, about 20,000 mailboxes, and what we found is when we, not just bandwidth, but we had connection issues, so the Outlook client itself,
right. So yes, this is a different topic.
All right.
I think I have it noted on a slide, but let's talk about it now. And we actually have a TechNet page dedicated to this topic because it does happen very, very frequently. And what the gentleman is talking about is when you switch from using Exchange on-premises to using Exchange online, Outlook is going to have to open a number of continuous open connections to that Exchange online server, and it's going to have to do that through your firewall and through your perimeter network. And as opposed to just connecting to your Exchange server, which has likely previously been just on-premises and not connecting through your internet firewall. So switching that to connecting through the internet firewall, Exchange actually opens 8 ports by default for a single mailbox. If you have admins or receptionists who open calendars for executives, that's going to be multiplied out by the number of those calendars that they have to open. So potentially there's a large number of ports. No, it's 8. It's 8, and then I think it's 2 for each extra calendar or some number, but there's a number that you have that's extra. Typically, the rule of thumb we use is you can get about 2,000 users on a firewall device, and the reason that it comes out at 2,000 is most of these devices are based on operating systems that enable up to 64,000 ports maximum, and then there's a number of them that are predefined for specific services. And so then you've got to divide by about 10, and then allow a bit of headroom, and you generally end up with a physical device working for about 2,000 users. The TechNet article has some better calculations than my what's in the back of my head there, but you very, very, very commonly run into this, because typically if I'm just browsing the web, I'm actually just opening a single connection to a web server at one time, and so we do run into this.
Right.
Yeah.
What's another?
I think I have a note to remind me to talk about this a bit later on. If you go to this URL, aka.ms/tuned, we have content about planning for internet connectivity and also troubleshooting internet connectivity for Office 365 specifically here. This is actually a TechNet site. This is just a short URL to it that I've got here.
Okay.
All right. So Exchange Online. SharePoint Online. SharePoint, it's HTTPS traffic. Users are using a website, they're viewing those web pages and uploading and downloading files. If they're using the web UI, if they're using the OneDrive for Business client, then that will synchronize data from their local hard drive or up onto their OneDrive for Business. It also uses HTTPS. It synchronizes files in 3.5 megabyte chunks, and it does it synchronizes up to 6 files at a time. There could be a lot of data that's being transferred, at least initially for users that sign on to OneDrive for Business as people load on data. And it's something that you do have to... Can I shut this? Oh, yeah. It's something... sorry about that. It's something you do have to plan for. Your steady state of OneDrive for Business is likely to be up to how many files do those users actually edit and what do they do day to day, and it's those files that are being synchronized up to SharePoint Online. You can baseline against your existing SharePoint servers that you have on premises. For a lot of people, they do find different loads for bandwidth going to SharePoint Online because of the large amount of capacity that we make available for users is often different to what people have on premises. So this can often make quite a difference to people in the amount of bandwidth that they do use. But it's something that you can work out and you can calculate for. Link Online. Link has very small traffic if you're using IM. Obviously not small amounts of traffic if you're using voice and video. Link does peer-to-peer, so if you're within your company intranet and on the same LAN, it will do peer-to-peer for two-person conversations which are not pre-planned. If you have a pre-planned meeting or if you have more than two people in the conversation, it's going to send that traffic via one of the Link Online servers, which is going to be in our data center. So if you just have that peer-to-peer, then you're not using your internet connection at all. You're not using your, you're not adding to your bandwidth. But if you're not, then you can take a look at 50 to 80k bits per second for voice, 280 to 4k 4 megabits per second for video, depending on resolution. And then desktop sharing is going to be similar again. Question?
Is any of that expected to change with the recent announcement about Skype for Business?
So those details are not expected to change in the near future with that announcement, no. You should assume that planning for link connectivity is the what's the best way to word this? Not significantly changed from link that you're familiar with right now. Although absolutely we are shifting to the name Skype, which is what was announced. Yep. All right. With link and also with SharePoint and Exchange, we actually have online bandwidth calculators. These are Excel spreadsheets. And they encourage you to go in and put in the number of users that you have at each site that you have, the different time zones for each of those sites, and then the sort of load that you expect from each of those users. You can have heavy, moderate, and light users that you can all spec in. You can hit calculate, and it will give you a good idea of what kind of bandwidth we would expect you to require for that. We do recommend measuring bandwidth and using baselining rather than just using the calculator. Because we have absolutely found that different types of organizations and have different usage scenarios, and those different usages, it really depends on how much your users make use of the service will depend on how much bandwidth rather than the services just being activated. So you're much better off to do baselining. All right. The last recommendation here is start with 20% headroom on your internet connection. Make sure you know what your headroom is available on each of your site's internet connectivity. And if all other things being equal, start with 20% excess capacity. You know, a lot of these internet connections are based on Ethernet and those types of protocols, which have issues with contention. They're not token ring anymore, so they don't wait for permission to send traffic and send data. They're just going to send it out. And if it collides with something else, they're going to send it again. So you quite often see retransmits on these networks just because of that. And if you get over 80% utilization, you're going to start seeing a lot more retransmits. You can't use 100% of your internet bandwidth unless you actually just have one sender and one receiver. So try for a 20% headroom to make sure that you have lots of availability for that kind of thing to go on. All right, a few other things with bandwidth, doing that planning. Migrations are going to be much more complicated, and you want to calculate these out differently to your steady state. If you're doing mailbox migrations, test some mailbox migrations before you go ahead and do all of the mailbox migrations. Mailbox migrations essentially are moving your whole mailbox from wherever they are today in Exchange on-premises to Exchange online. And you know, it's mailbox plus mailbox 1 plus mailbox 2 plus mailbox 3, etc., to figure out how much data you're actually transferring. Exchange Online will limit the amount of traffic that you can send in a mailbox migration, and you should read about how that's going to affect how long your migration takes. SMTP traffic is something you want to look at. If you are having inbound internet mail come into your Exchange on-premises server, then that's not going to change just because you've subscribed to Office 365 until you actually change your MX record to point to Office 365 and the Exchange Online server that you're using. Once you change that, your mail is going to be going to Exchange Online instead of your Exchange on-premises, and it's worthwhile looking at how this impacts your data. You can get into tricky situations if you leave your inbound mail going to Exchange on-premises and you've migrated all of your users off to Exchange Online, you're effectively going to be having all of that mail coming into your on-premises server and then back off onto your online mailbox, effectively doubling the amount of bandwidth that you're using on your firewall just because you haven't updated that MX record yet. For administrative traffic, this is largely going to be negligible. A few of the types of traffic that we have, DirSync or Azure Active Directory sync tool is going to be synchronizing changes to user records. You shouldn't notice very much traffic based on that or any of the other admin traffic that we have going on. The admin portal doesn't use very much traffic, so we don't expect very much to be happening there. All right, a few other real quick things. One recommendation is to use your mailboxes. There's lots of space in Exchange Online mailboxes, but if you're using archives, anyone using archives, Exchange Online archives, If you're using archives, those are not cached offline. So when your users are accessing the archive, they actually have to connect to the Exchange server. They're in online mode only. So, you know, for performance reasons, we recommend people use their really large Exchange Online mailboxes instead of those archives if possible. Do upgrade to Outlook 2013 SP1 as fast as possible. Has some significant increases there. There's some other tips there. Talked about the MX records already. Use our calculators, try those out. Do test migrations, particularly for mailbox migrations. All right. Some final topics on planning. If you're using WAN accelerators, WAN accelerators can help to improve performance under some circumstances between two different points. Some WAN accelerator companies have specific Office 365 offerings as well, where they'll have a cloud-based endpoint. WAN accelerator always has two endpoints, a sender and a receiver, or one node and the other node. It's important to know that Microsoft has not tested these WAN accelerators. We do testing across the internet, but not with WAN accelerators in place. And we do ask that if you have a problem with Office 365, that you take WAN accelerators out of that equation and revert back to just using the public internet. However, I know some customers have had great experiences with different WAN accelerators. If you have a firewall where you have a policy that users can only connect to some internet sites and not others, then you're going to have to enable all of the Office 365 either IP addresses or DNS URLs in order for your users to be able to connect to those. We recommend using DNS for firewall filtering because our DNS lists are updated with more advanced notice. Our IP addresses sometimes can be updated on our TechNet page very close to when they are implemented in production. It can be tricky to keep up with those. We have an RSS feed where you can watch those. So if you have a firewall policy, an internet connection policy, where users are expected to not connect to certain sites, then make sure to keep track of that. All right. So the third part of the talk is about troubleshooting. And based on what we've talked about, learning a bit about Microsoft's infrastructure, a bit about capacity planning, I want to talk a bit about how you would go about troubleshooting performance on a particular site where you're having a performance issue there. And so the first thing to think about is what can I do? What kind of questions do I need to ask? And how do I go about identifying this? And troubleshooting a performance problem is different to troubleshooting an outage. If your users have an outage or a failure or a fault or something that's just broken and not working, it's very easy to get them to describe to you what that is and to show that to you. But if they're just having a performance issue, often it's much more difficult even to get them to explain it because, you know, something's going slower than what they want is really what we're talking about here. We're not talking about something that is failing and not working and stopping them from doing their job. It's just a bit slower than what they're used to. So I generally recommend spending some time getting some information from the user, asking about are all users or just some users impacted? What time of the day does it happen? Does it happen, I don't know, in a hotel when lots of people come together and it doesn't happen out of hours? Sometimes for crazy reasons we try and troubleshoot these things out of hours and they all seem to work fine, and then when users come in the morning they don't work so well. Sometimes lunchtime can be the killer. A problem only happens when I come back from lunch. Real interesting scenarios that you can get to there. But it doesn't happen at the start of the day. So what's with that? Has anything changed on the customer network configuration recently? And then getting details about the network topology. Where are the offices located? How are they interconnected? How do they get internet connectivity at those different offices? And getting a repro of the issue. What does it actually mean to be slow? What does it look like? Can you get a video of what the user is saying is slow and what they're replicating that? There's actually a tool in Windows called the Problem Steps Recorder, which started, I think, in Windows 7 that you can run. If you run psr.exe, it will let you record a video of the screen that the user is experiencing while they're having the problem. And it guides the user through doing that, and it creates a package which includes that video and the steps that they went through. And you can get your user to share that with you and you can see what's going on and take a look at it. Another great way to get a repro, particularly of Office 365, is to connect with the user and on a link call and have them share their desktop and have them run a repro of the problem there. I use this quite often with people reporting performance issues. You know, if link can work for them, that tells me something. But then if they can share their desktop and they can actually share what the issue is that they're seeing, it's really helpful to be able to see what that is. Link also conveniently lets you hit record, and you can record the screen sharing so that you can take a look at it later. If you have a video of a problem, videos are great because they typically allow you to look at timestamps, and you can say, okay, well, I know exactly how long it took from when you hit that button until when that screen came up, because I got a video and I can see it in the timestamps for the video, and I can time it. I don't have to rely on a user with a stopwatch or other random nondescript things that people talk about it in terms of what their performance is like. Sometimes, unfortunately, people complain that their performance is poor when actually they have really good performance. I have been on these calls where you'll talk with the customer and they'll show you, yeah, that's slow, and it's actually not. It's performing really, really well. And their perception of what performance should be versus what they are seeing is the only thing that you can point to. And the last thing here, before you bring someone in, is to form a V-team. Your V-team is going to want to include people who have access to internet perimeter networks and firewalls and different networks. And so getting together a V-team of people who have those kind of permissions and access is very important. So once you have a troubleshooting engineer, someone who has access to and training about network performance, you can expect to be on site for a couple of days. We do recommend that you do this kind of troubleshooting on site, because oftentimes it is all about the internet connection that the user has where they are seeing the performance issue. A lot of these issues that we see come down to being there and looking at what those performance issues are, trying to find the firewall that has more than 2,000 users that are connected through it, or whatever that issue might be. Expect a couple of days. Have people on standby at other customer internet connection locations so that they can you can call them up and talk to them about what the things that you might want to ask. And make sure you have the network topology available there. So the first thing you're going to do is run some basic tests and then form a hypothesis for what you think the issue might be after you've isolated what the problem is that the customer is seeing. And then we're going to run some more in-depth tests to really try and confirm that issue, that hypothesis that you're seeing. These are some of the common issues that we find. NAT, first off, just measuring round trip time. TCP window scaling is a common issue. Want to talk a little bit about that. And these 12 issues are ones that we see time and time again. And they're typical issues that you see when moving from a customer that has internet connectivity from doing web browsing to moving to using a SaaS application, moving to using Outlook with multiple connections up to Exchange Online. All right, and then once you get there, you can recommend some action. Okay. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to look and identify the network service endpoints. We want to know, where is the server that we're connecting to for Exchange Online? Where is the server for SharePoint and for Link Online? And once we know those, we're going to go and run some very, very basic tests. I want to look at, what is the round trip time to connect to those servers? And what is the routing that I use to connect to those servers? As part of that, I also really want to know the round trip time to the perimeter network. I want to know how long it takes to connect to the perimeter network where firewalls are for this user, and then how long from the perimeter network across the internet service provider and network operators to the data center. Having those two pieces of information, and let's take a quick look at that. All right, so having those two pieces of information, I can narrow in on where my problem is, whether it's in the perimeter network of the customer or whether it's something on the internet, an ISP that's using some routing that is unfavorable towards us. So I want to use this tool called PS Ping, and this is similar to the Ping tool, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Ping uses ICMP protocol, and PS Ping extends that. It can either use ICMP protocol, which it'll use if I run it with this, with just to my URL here, paul20.sharepoint.com. But if I put on a port number on the end of that, PSPing will actually send TCP packets instead of ICMP packets. That's important for a couple of reasons. A lot of people block ICMP packets, so as soon as you get blocked, it's useless. Also, ICMP packets may not be routed the same way as TCP packets are used. TCP packets are what we run HTTPS over. It's what we actually connect to Office 365 using. So if you're using, if you happen to have different routing for ICMP packets, you're not really looking at you're not going to see any of the problems that you might have with TCP. All right, so I'm using TCP here. This is a sysinternals tool that you can download from TechNet. And you can see it just looks like ping, like I would expect. And it's showing me that to connect to my SharePoint server, I am about 50 milliseconds or so. It says the average there is 50.56 to connect to that. So that's how far to connect from me to there. I'd also like to use that to connect to my perimeter network. Come back. All right. Because I want to know how much of that is connected to my perimeter network and how much is connecting outbound, and that'll tell me whether I have to be working with my internet connection or whether I have to be working with my internal connection. So the second thing I wanted to talk about in terms of troubleshooting is this concept of TCP window scaling. And TCP window scaling is something that... It's a concept which... using the TCP protocol. The TCP protocol is a protocol where I have to be able to send out multiple packets from my server to my client and not wait for the ACK for each of those packets. TCP requires an ACK for each packet, but it doesn't require that ACK to happen immediately. I can send 1, 2, 3 packets and then have my ACK come back for all of those 3 packets later on. And then I know I can send packets 4, 5, and 6 and I can get those ACKs come back later. The window that you have talks about the amount of essentially cache that I can have or buffer open while I wait for those ACKs to come back. Because, you know, I have to be able to resend those packets if one of them is not acknowledged. So I have to have a buffer that I can wait for that to come back. And this is very important if you have networks which are high latency. In other words, they take a long time for the packets to get there, but also very high bandwidth. And of recent times, this represents the internet as we know it. And a long time ago, the internet used to have both high latency and low bandwidth. So you didn't really need a lot of packets to be outstanding because you could only send a few of them down the pipe before you had to get these ACKs anyway. But in today's world where we have, you know, 10 gigabits is our minimum sort of purchased amount of internet capacity that you get, then you can send an awful lot of those 1,500-byte packets down that before you're going to get your ACKs back with any kind of reasonable latency. So what this means is the TCP protocol, we've had to expand the window or the buffer size by using this flag called TCP window scaling. And this was actually done quite a long time ago. We introduced this flag so that these buffers could be much larger. The maximum can be 1 gigabyte. 1 gigabyte with TCP window scaling enabled, and without it, it's only about 64K. And so what happened, though, was this flag was enabled, and then a lot of networking equipment failed when this flag was turned on. So then, over time, it became the norm for this flag to be turned off. So we're defaulting to the internet without window scaling available. I have messed up how I'm presenting here somehow. Yeah. All right, so as a result of this, if you have a 300 millisecond round trip time and then your maximum throughput is going to be 1.71 megabits per second. So if you have a 10 megabit per second connection and you have this 300 millisecond round trip time, if window scaling is turned off, you're only able to use about one megabit of that 10 megabit line. So it's a little bit tricky to follow this logic, but it means I can stuff 1.71 megabits of data into that pipe before I have to get ACKs to come back because my buffer is full. And even though I can send more data down there, I can't because my ACKs haven't come back. I've got to wait for the ACK to come back. If you turn on Windows scaling, your maximum there is 447 megabits per second with Windows scaling. So there's a huge difference you can see there. And a recent example of this, this is showing a 14 megabyte PDF file being downloaded from a site in Australia to a tenant out of Europe, a SharePoint Online tenant out of Europe. And with Windows scaling turned off, it was turned off because there was an old piece of networking equipment on the perimeter network for the customer. It took 507 seconds to download a 14 megabyte file. And so we turned on Windows scaling, we got it down to 21 seconds. So there's a huge possibility for change there if you have longer round trip times on your networks. Here's how you take a look at this. There's a couple of traces here from Netmon, and you can see this first trace in the yellow highlighted section, along with all of the flags in the TCP setup, you can see this negotiating scale factor zero. This is an endpoint telling you that the largest scale factor that it can accept is zero, i.e. none at all. And this is indicating that window scaling is turned off. Once you see this in your network trace, you've then got to go and find what piece of networking equipment between the client and the server actually turned this off. And then you want to enable that on that networking equipment, or better yet, chuck it out and buy some new stuff. All right. So it's real interesting. It often, but it's a huge improvement if you can find one of these things. All right, I think we're going to run out of time in a bit here, but I want to tell you about a couple more of these things. One is GeoDNS issues. Now, if you have a customer site using Office 365 and you have multiple locations for that customer, it's very common for each of those locations to have internet connectivity, but for only one of those locations to be used for DNS lookups. And this is just historical how people set up these networks. So if you have a customer network with these three sites, one in North America, one in Australia, and one in Europe, and maybe your internet egress point is in all three of those, but your DNS access point is only in Europe. Now, Office 365 uses something called GeoDNS, which really just means we give you a different IP address for the DNS lookup depending on where you are in the world. And if you're only doing these DNS lookups in Europe, but you're doing, you actually have internet egress in all three continents, then you're going to be pointed to our servers, which are in Europe. Now, we talked before about how your tenant is only in one region, but actually, for Exchange Online, we will point you to the mail, the cafe, the front-end server, wherever you are. So a lot of your connection is going to go to that cafe server, and a lot of your a lot of the processing that we do is on that cafe server. It's still going to go and get your mail from your mailbox. But if you think about it, if you're in Australia down here and you get DNS lookup out of Europe, then we're going to give you a cafe front-end server that is in Europe. Now, what if your tenant is actually in APAC? Well, then what's going to happen is you're going to get internet egress out of Australia, and then you're going to connect across the internet to Europe to our front-end server, and then you're going to connect from that front-end server back to our mailbox server, which is in APAC. This is going to be really, really slow and perform really badly. So looking at how your DNS lookups happen and actually using Netmon to trace some of your DNS lookups, look at how long they take, can be really valuable and can teach you a lot. All right, the last one I want to show you here, we're up on time. Is to talk about what you can do for testing for routing and network peering. So Traceroute is a tool that we use for doing this. Traceroute is going to tell us what is the route that an ICMP packet uses to connect from the client where I am to the server. You've got to identify the server endpoint that you're connecting to, and that's different depending on what service you're using from Office 365. For example, Exchange is always going to connect to this outlook.office365.com. Which is, in fact, a GeoDNS entry, so it will differ depending on where you are. SharePoint will connect to your tenantname.sharepoint.com, and that's going to be the endpoint where we connect to. So you want to check your routing for these different services. But here's an example here of what you can look at in this routing. If I do a traceroute here, and this example is from the UK, connecting to actually outlook-apacnorth.office365.com. So Artificially, we've created a traceroute that's connecting from Europe across to APAC, which is going a long way. And you can see the skyrouter.home is the originating router on the client. And then you can see fairly reasonably quickly, we get to this ntwk.msn.net. Microsoft's network actually shows DNS, so you can it does these reverse DNS lookups, and that is showing you where you've connected to the Microsoft network. And it's done so at this ASH node. So it looks like even though this user was in the UK, they've actually first connected to the Microsoft network in Virginia. I might have expected that to first happen in the UK, but it doesn't seem to have in this case. So then we can see from Virginia, we're connecting through the Microsoft network down to the final node there on line 15, which shows the three letters SG2. If you can see that SG2 in the DNS name there, ntwk.msn.net, that's indicating it's one of our Singapore routers. Sometimes you can look this stuff up and you can see and it's obvious. Other times you can't. You can't rely on this DNS, but it's really helpful. It's a good rule of thumb. You can also use the number of milliseconds as a way of getting yourself some additional information and trying to figure out where that is. What you're looking for here is you're looking for, does this make sense? Is this a reasonable routing across the internet from where this customer is to where the server is? And if it's not reasonable, if, you know, for example, it's connecting from the UK to New York and then back to Europe and then to a server in the US, which we see rather strangely often, this would be some crazy internet routing that you'd want to go and talk to the ISP or the network operators that you're working with and ask them about their routing. All right. So we talked about NAT and firewall port exhaustion already. That was the third or fourth of these tests that I wanted to talk to you in the troubleshooting. We have a whole variety of additional documentation about these kind of troubleshooting. Remember I said there were 12 very commonly run across issues that you have. We have actually on that aka.ms/tune site, which is our TechNet page, we have started documenting these and publishing guidance about those. We do also have some other documentation in the form of employee blogs and talks from TechEd Europe that we did recently, talking to you about all of these different issues that you can walk through. One that you can come up against quite often is SharePoint site customization. It needs to be done quite differently on-premises to online. There are more restrictions to site customization online. And so if you're seeing very poor performance of a SharePoint site that has been customized online, go and take a look at the same customer's OneDrive for Business homepage. This is a separate site collection, and it's very rarely customized. And if that performs well, you know that there's something in the site customizations that you've got to go and look for. We have some detail about that you can take a look at. Client software being unsupported. Make sure that you have the latest clients. Link has its own troubleshooting tool that you can take a look at, that you can run. And these URLs may be out of date. You might have to feel free to ping me afterwards if these URLs are out of date. But we do have these Java applet-based troubleshooting tools for Link that you can go in and get some indicators of what's going on with your connectivity to Link. Sometimes they can be very helpful. All right, so summary here. There are a ton of things that you can do to improve performance of Office 365. In addition to the fantastic infrastructure that Microsoft has made available, you have to be cognizant of the fact that the internet is between that infrastructure and your users, and so is the perimeter network that they have in their location. And so all of these things, you want to take a look at them, and understand where they're at if you're going through troubleshooting or needing to figure some things out because you're not seeing the performance that you want to. All right, so that's all I have today. Are there any more questions about any parts of this? One question? So I think, are you talking about mail delivery, or it's not synchronizing the cache? Particular emails take a long time. And is it emails from internal users or external?
Both.
Yeah. We actually have, I don't know what it's likely to be, but I do hear about this problem from time to time. We do actually have on the service health dashboard, we have a indicator of whether mail delivery is delayed. And there are some details you can go into and take a look at in Office 365 to find out about that. I'd start with raising a support request and getting someone at Microsoft to look into that. Yeah. Yep.
Well, just I would say one comment, because we had similar things like that where you have people that when you migrate, some people are migrated, some people weren't, and they complain about messages. Either said, in this case, it was like messages they were scanning from a multifunction device, and it was the SPF record. It wasn't a trusted sender.
Oh, from like a photocopier or something that you were scanning? Yep.
It would sitting out in EOP for like a day, and it would show up a day later, right? It was sitting out there. So you can go and check your quarantine if you're using it. I don't know if you're if you're using EOP, you can check out there.
EOP is on by default for Exchange Online users.
Right, so I would start there because it could be something simple like that.
Right.
There's so many.
And if you're using 2010, did you run the desktop tool? Because a lot of communication errors come up if you don't run the desktop tool.
Oh, right.
Yeah. For 2010. Right?
Yeah, don't use 2010. we do actually, for clients with Office 365, we have a 12-month support policy for the client. So if you're getting Office 365 Pro Plus, Pro Plus is 2013 SP1, but you can hold on to that version for 12 months before it's out of support. It's a different support policy than we previously had with on-prem, because of course we are changing the cloud services all the time. There are monthly updates to those. So we support the clients back 12 months. So getting off 2010 is important. We need to get people onto 2013. Yeah.
One other question is about the slowness of clients. So we're in the middle of migrations, and we've just seen some performance, meaning the client itself. The mailbox move goes fine on the back end. You do all the troubleshooting and the ultimate.
So the clients are just slow when they're running?
Correct, right. So general slowness. So the ultimate thing we do is we create the profile, or we recreate it, so we don't have enough time with the volume of people. I was just curious if that's, is there any, have you seen that? Is that any? There doesn't seem to be any visible
switching between
issues, but just starting.
So you mean in the UX of the client, like you're saying, if you're just switching folders in your mailbox, or
slow, and they have complained of general mail delivery slowness. Not they maybe use. I know sometimes they're used to. I send an email to an on-prem user and it shows up like that. But this is more just general slowness.
So I'd be if you said that if they had multiple mailboxes or multiple people's calendars open. I would go, okay. I actually was working with a guy the other day. He's a guy I work with quite a lot. And I noticed he had just a whole lot of people's calendars added to Outlook. And I was like, what are you doing that? And I saw him do it. He was looking for meeting times. He just wanted to find when he could meet with people. And I was like, well, do you know you can just click on the scheduling assistant and it will load all those? No. Do you realize having all those calendars open, it's connecting and downloading all those people's calendars in the background? No.
Yeah. And that could be part of it. So, and that's what we try to explain. But it's hard for us to do, actually impossible for us to do any kind of triage of the state of a Outlook client before we do the migration. And the mailbox move is great. And then, of course, deleting the profile and starting from scratch, that fixes their problem. But then
kind of does, but then they've got to set up from scratch and resync.
And they may not, to your point.
It's unfortunately, or for whatever reason, it is the best practice of, can you create a new profile and do you still have the same issue?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Because it does make a lot of them go away.
Why? Because we can't go into the old. And probably a lot of it's just user. That's one of the things we see a lot is, well, why are you doing it that way? Well, so and so
Right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so is anyone planning to go back and take a look at their network connectivity headroom and figure out what that is? Yeah? A lot of people, someone sets up the internet connection, and it's not a typically monitored thing. And you're typically not, it's not going to be an Office 365 specific thing that causes you headroom problem. But it's a great best practice to know what it is, understand where it is. It's fantastic working at a site where the policy is 50% headroom on your network connectivity. My desk at Microsoft, I have a 100 megabit connection from my desk to pretty much anywhere out onto the internet. It's one of the tricky things about working on performance on Office 365 and doing it from the Microsoft campus is we are considered a network operator. We connect to the Microsoft network, and we have a corporate network, and we don't, of course, have all our internal networks connected into the Office 365 data centers. We have a separate network for that, but the interconnection bandwidth is enormous, so we have really good connectivity into that. So I spend a bunch of my time remote desktoped out to remote VMs in different parts of the world to try and see what those what it's like connecting there. Was there a question up here or comment?
I have one quick question. Do we have access to the queue viewer within Exchange whenever we have it online?
I don't believe so. You mean the mail queues and taking a look at that? Yeah.
So we don't have a way to monitor where a piece of mail is sitting at any given time.
I haven't looked into that. I don't think so. You've got access to whatever you can get at through the Office 365 admin portal, but you can't go any further than that.
One thing that was mentioned one of the admin meetings the other day is there's an API for going to get.
There's an API for it?
There's an API for just to get an account, but you can't enumerate it.
You can do quarantines and see if something's stuck in quarantine.
Yeah. You do a trace.
You can do traces, but then you have to get pretty granular. Okay. Yeah, like he said, you can do.
It's just to what your queue counts are. Right, yeah. I'm not getting emails.
Sure.
Hey, since we have a little bit more time, it might be, I'm not sure that we do. When does the next session start?
10:30.
30 minutes?
No, 10:30.
Oh, 15? Hey, was anyone interested in some of these other topics that we have for troubleshooting? I touched on packet loss a little bit. We talked about port exhaustion already. That was your issue there with the firewall. Packet loss is really interesting. If you think about TCP, the protocol, it expects packet loss. And so when you run a network monitor and you're looking at traces, you should expect to see retransmits. You don't see packet loss, of course. The packet's lost, you don't see it. But you do see retransmits and something called fast retransmits. A fast retransmit is anticipating packet loss and retransmitting it just in case. So there's a bunch of retransmits that go on. And typically, generally, if you're seeing less than 1% of the total data on your network trace as being retransmits, that's okay. You should expect that because at some point, two clients are going to send a packet at the same time, they're going to collide, and one of them is going to be marked as lost. And so if you're under about 1%, that doesn't matter. If you get a lot of packet loss, that's something to look into. You've got a problem. I had an example recently where I was looking at this and we had like 10% packet loss. And sure enough, downloads were taking a really, really long time. Packet loss tends to generate some of this back off in the TCP protocols where it will say, well, okay, my packets were lost, so I'll delay a bit. I'll wait a bit longer and wait a bit longer. And this can cause it to go really, really slow. So that's why packet loss is on there. It doesn't necessarily mean you have a broken cable or anything going on. It might mean you've run out of capacity of a particular piece of network connectivity, or it might mean you have a configuration issue where some of the packets are going through and some of them are not because there's a configuration problem on a networking card or something like that. That's a really interesting one. It's very hard to debug and figure where that is. Packet loss that essentially is a fault, but it's only causing an intermittent loss of packets. We talked about routing and peering. TCP idle time settings are interesting. This is where, this is the comeback from lunch problem, where I have maybe people who leave Outlook running all day, like everyone does. They go away for lunch, and they come back after lunch and find that Outlook's really slow, it's hung, it takes 10 minutes to respond, and they don't know what's going on. It could be an example where you have a perimeter network and your firewall is actively closing connections that are seen as idle. And what can happen there is your clients don't realize their connections have been closed, but the firewall has closed them. So you're not getting through to Exchange Online anymore. And the client has to figure out that the connection has been closed and then it's got to reopen another one. This can take quite some time because of there's an exponential back off there. And so you can adjust that idle time in your firewall, or you can actually set your clients for TCP keep alive and have a shorter TCP keep alive set in the client. And this will trick the firewall into thinking that the connection should still be open. So that's one we see. It's another, I've moved from web browsing to having Outlook connecting to Exchange Online. DNS performance we talked about a little bit. It's worthwhile running a network monitor at some point and looking at how long do your DNS lookups actually take. It's also worth looking at how long do your AD authentications also take. If you're doing anything which requires AD authentication, maybe in a proxy server, if you have a proxy server that is authenticated, those auths may take some time to go through. All right, so there's a few other interesting things there. I see doors opening here and things, so better let people move on. Thank you very much for coming along. I have another talk this afternoon. I'll be talking about identity management and identity integration with Office 365, so good times. Thanks very much.